From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Megan Mack. We begin this week's podcast with news from the University of Rochester. The results of an independent investigation on sexual harassment allegations at the university were announced this week. The report concluded that while Professor Florian Jaeger acted inappropriately and exercised poor judgment, he did not break the law or violate campus policy. Celeste Kidd is one of the women who filed the complaints against him. She says she's disappointed, angry, and frustrated by those findings. University of Rochester President Joel Seligman resigned Thursday, saying that the university needs to heal, and that requires a new leader. WXXI spoke with Seligman in his first interview following that resignation, and one of the questions our news director, Randy Gorbman, asked him was if he felt there were things he could have done differently in the way he handled the complaints. You'll hear his response, and then you'll hear Celeste Kidd when she appeared on Connections.
I think that's a fair question, and I want to reflect upon it. I will make a different point, however, and I think someone needs to make this. I think there's some things the students and faculty could have done here quite differently. And the most important thing I think they need to reflect upon is the rush to judgment they made on the basis of allegations rather than evidence, and their unwillingness in some instances to wait for the Mary Jo White report to come in and instead to insist upon earlier decisions being made before the full facts were known. And I will be quite blunt. I don't think you should run the university or any important institution in our society on the basis of a 24-hour news cycle. I think we are the most enduring and perpetual institutions in Western society and indeed in Eastern society today and throughout the world because we carefully and diligently employ processes by which we can get to enduring results. We don't shoot from the hip. And I think that's something everybody should be reflecting upon at this point.
But in terms of your behavior, do you, again, I know we all kind of look back at our own lives and professional lives, say we could have done this or that. Did you have many regrets?
Obviously, I have some regrets, and I want to reflect upon them. And I'm now out of the storm. This is a job that goes 14, 16 hours a day, sometimes 6 or 7 days a week. It is nonstop. It's not just this issue. It's a whole lot of other things going on. And I want to step back and rethink a lot, but I don't have instant judgments on this, and sorry if people want them. I'll be ready to talk about this when the time is right.
No instant judgments, and instead President Seligman wants the students and faculty to think about their own regrets. So I thought it was an interesting response, to say the least. Celeste?
The accusation of shooting from the hip, of a rush to judgment, when you're talking about not just me, not just what I experienced, but more than a dozen other women experienced. That Rolling Stone reference was not just offensive to me. It was ludicrous, given how many women were coming forward saying that their experiences, it's like in the department, their access to educational opportunities were harmed. It's like that they suffered abuses at the hands of Florian Jaeger. The women who spoke, it's like, did so at a high personal cost and risk, dredging these things up. I was like, not only was emotionally exhausting, dredging them up repeatedly, even more so, Florian Jaeger has a history of retaliation, and they were afraid of that. And they came forward because they were committed to making things better for the next generation of students. They did so with a lot of thought. It's like they did so with a lot of care. And to accuse that many women of shooting from the hip is offensive. The students at the University of Rochester, the other women who may experience things like this, who haven't come forward yet, who are thinking about it, it sets a terrible example. They deserve better.
You can hear the full news conference about the report's findings, the news conference held by the complainants, and WXXI's interview with Joel Seligman on our website, and that's WXXINews.org. Next, if Frederick Douglass were alive today, would he be optimistic about race relations improving in this country? We talked about that question with the organizers of Re-Energizing the Legacy of Frederick Douglass. It's a year-long county and citywide celebration of Douglass's life and work. Blue Cease and Carvin Eisen are the co-organizers of that series of events and initiatives. They celebrate the 200th anniversary of the year of Douglass's birth. One of the initiatives is to move the city's monument of Frederick Douglass to a more prominent location. First, you'll hear Eisen talk about the statue, and then you'll hear both of the organizers discuss their thoughts on how Douglass viewed progress in his day and how he might have viewed it in 2018.
The county already has plans to move the monument from its present location in the bowl of Highland Park to the corner of South Avenue and Robinson Drive in a much more prominent position with lighting and seating, etc. So your caller is on point. It should be moved. No one knows where it is, and that's really, really important. And I also think that this is critical, too, that at a time in American history where monuments are being used to break communities apart, such as Charlottesville in the Commonwealth of Virginia, for example, where hate and death were brought to the streets of a community, this monument is, in fact, bringing people together.
Our guests have mentioned many of the elements you're going to see around the city of Rochester. There will be events, discussions, exhibitions, monuments that you're going to see in different places. In the words of Carvin and Blue, they're going to try to put Frederick Douglass in front of you everywhere you go. And one of the things that you can do is go out to Roco. And No Soil Better is the name of what's going on there. So, and there's a reason for that. So Blue Seas, tell us about why No Soil Better.
This is a quote from Douglass in a speech he gave in 1857 in response to the Dred Scott decision. He said, "I know of no soil better adapted to the growth of reform than American soil. I know of no country where the conditions for effecting great changes in the settled order of things, for the development of right ideas of liberty and humanity, are more favorable than here in these United States."
So that quote with the phrase, "no soil better," I want to ask both of our other guests here about something that comes to mind for me, which is this. That quote is really optimistic, I think. It's still optimistic about affecting change, saying there's no soil better for doing it, that it can happen. Juxtapose that with one of, I think, the really important modern writers, Ta-Nehisi Coates, who at some point last year was on Stephen Colbert's program. And there was this clip that goes viral that I think Stephen Colbert wasn't really ready for. But he was talking to Ta-Nehisi Coates about a number of issues and kind of closed by asking him, like, you know, can you give me something that would give me hope? Because Colbert is basically saying, look, as a white guy, I want progress. I want to believe. And he's feeling his privilege, I think. And he's saying to Ta-Nehisi Coates, you know, what's something that you can do to make me an optimist, give me hope? And Ta-Nehisi Coates is like, nothing. My job is not to give you hope. And frankly, he doesn't feel a whole lot of hope himself. And it was tough. It was a tough moment, I think, for Colbert. The clip went viral. I think there was a lot of layers to that that were very interesting. But that is not necessarily the same kind of tone as the quote that inspires No Soil Better. It's interesting. So, Douglass, would you call him generally, based on his writings, an optimist?
To begin with, Ta-Nehisi Coates is a brilliant writer,
yeah,
a brilliant thinker about contemporary culture. So for him to say he has no hope, you know, I can't second guess him and say that he has hope. But I would say that based on some of the projects that he's doing, particularly Black Panther, that he probably has a little bit of hope.
Yeah,
in there.
Yeah.
Because I'm pretty much hoping that movie is going to do like extraordinary
I think it's going to do boffo box
yeah,
office.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
So, and the magazines or the comic books as well. Graphic novels, I think, is the more appropriate way. But I think you absolutely have to be hopeful, and many people in Rochester have been hopeful as a result of Frederick Douglass. And not only have they been hopeful, they have accomplished things that indicate their hope. For example, people like Mildred Johnson or David Gant or Lena Gant or Mayor Lovely Warren or Garth Fagan. These are people who all bathe in the light of Frederick Douglass.
Next, this week on the show was our annual Dialogue on Disability Week, and we kicked it off with a conversation about autism. According to new research published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, the rates of autism spectrum disorder among U.S. children remained stable from 2014 to 2016. That's a change from earlier studies, which suggested that autism rates rose steadily over the past 20 years. Now, the authors of the recent study pointed to changes in diagnostic criteria, more public awareness, and more children being referred to doctors as among the principal reasons for those earlier increases. In this clip, you'll hear Sandra Erb Petruccione talk about her 34-year-old daughter, Carrie. Carrie has autism and lives in a group home with her best friend. Sandra says when Carrie was diagnosed, autism was relatively unheard of, so there weren't many programs or services available for their family. That remained true as Carrie aged out of the school system. Here's Sandra.
Up until age 21, as part of the New York State school systems, she is provided with services automatically. After age 21, what changes is you have to go in search of those services, whether it's occupational therapy or speech therapy. You also have to go in search of what do you do with them throughout the day. They're no longer in school 6 hours a day. Then there's the search of what's out there program-wise. That is, back when we were looking for Carrie, they were many, many sheltered workshop programs, many programs where, you know, they would just come in and sit for 6 hours or 8 hours. And if you want to continue to challenge and develop, those are not programs that are viable or even interesting. So there was a big search of where is she going to go, what's she going to do, what programs is she going to be a part of. And then as she got older, you know, you're faced with, this is my child is perfectly healthy physically, do I keep her home with me until I'm in a nursing home, or or do I try to seek out some kind of full lifestyle for her to live so that in my demise, she's not devastated. So those are the kinds of challenges that we're still faced with. As I mentioned, this home that we are involved with now, LAI helps run us, but there aren't a lot of group home availabilities for young adults who have disabilities, whether it's autism or any others. I also have the interesting perspective that I am an occupational therapist by profession, and I work in a school district, and I work with, you know, children of all ages who are on the spectrum. So I see it in my own home, mm-hmm. in my job, and where they're going after high school is always a challenge for the parents, for the student. So those are different things than you work with while the child is still of school age.
By the way, you mentioned sheltered workshops, and one of the things I learned in the Exited podcast is that for years, the rules are different in what people who work in such facilities get paid.
Right.
And some of the concerns about, for example, $2.50 an hour.
Right.
And the concerns about, you know, someone wanting to find a place, to find value, to be valued, but also what can facilities afford to pay, and if we don't have the same rules on just minimum wage, by the way, are we setting lesser value? You know, how do you view that issue?
It's a bigger issue than that, because if you're a young adult and you are diagnosed with a disability and you live on Social Security income, you can't make money. You can't earn money, because if you do that, then you become disqualified to earn Social Security disability or your Medicaid benefits. And on the flip side, if you are earning money, it's nowhere near enough to cover those expenses. Mm-hmm. So that puts you in a whole other realm of where do you go, what do you do, how do you validate yourself and, you know, feel like a contributing member of society.
So Sandy, what is one thing from your parent perspective that you want to see change for other families just like yours, especially families that are getting new diagnoses? We've got the Golisano Autism Center set to break ground in the spring. It's meant to streamline and bring a lot under one roof, make it more accessible. What else can be done?
I think that all the things that can be done for young children now is extremely important, because even in our own experience, early intervention was Carrie's best goal. But I think after you reach the age 21, you fall into a black hole. And so more things need to be done, because you don't ever cure autism. It's going to be there at some level for the rest of your life. And once you're past 21, there still needs to be things out there for these young individuals to do. Those things include a place to live, a place to have some kind of employment or some kind of input to society and your life, so that your life is full and whole. And there's also a lot of questions out there about the monies. if you are working, does it impact on your Social Security disability? Can you make enough not to have that impacted on? And I believe all parents out there, especially with adult children who are living on Social Security disability, are terrified about the political atmosphere right now regarding that funding.
And just a reminder about Exited, that's WXXI's podcast about young people with intellectual and developmental disabilities figuring out life after high school. There are two more episodes coming soon, and you can hear them by visiting exitedpodcast.org or search Exited in any podcast app. We'll end the week with a conversation about ethics in the broadcast news industry. 2017 marked the 30th anniversary of the James L. Brooks film Broadcast News. If you haven't seen it, we recommend it. It's an inside look into the business and some of the tough decisions reporters and producers have to make. Plus, there are some really funny physical comedy moments that you have to see. But back to the news, the film presented ethical dilemmas, including a network news anchor faking tears during an interview about date rape. Some say the film also served as a warning for how an increasing emphasis on attractive anchors and entertainment-driven ideas were growing at the expense of quality journalism. In this clip, you'll hear local broadcast professionals discuss what they see as threats to quality journalism. You'll hear Rebecca LeClaire, owner of LeClaire Communications and a former television news anchor and reporter. But first, here's Adam Chodak, anchor and managing editor at WROC-TV.
I think the biggest threat is not so much any mandates from the corporate structure or anything like that. It's just time. We are pulled in so many different directions with social media. A lot of us are one-man banding now, which I did for years. I think that is the biggest threat because we want it to be complete, but how much can you pack in a day? So if I could offer one suggestion for the industry is just give us a little bit more time to put these things together.
On the air as well.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All of us felt those pressures because, you know, you're expected to be tweeting, putting things on Facebook, and producing your story for the 5, 6, 7, and 11, and you have to have a different angle each time. It's almost undue pressure to be able to do all of that and double check your sources. I mean, it really weighs heavily on those journalists, and we're doing our best that we can. But you talk about completeness, you know, just even two sides to the stories. Well, there's usually five sides to every story, and whether you can get all five stories. I can still remember, I graduated in 86, so I started my career, you know, in 87, 88, I was just that new journalist out there. I came here to Rochester in 88, and that was back when there were weekly protests outside of Genesee Hospital over the abortion issue. And it got so bad. We had so much criticism from both sides, they would time our sound bites. You know, we'd go out and do the interviews and get both sides. And once you produced your piece and it aired, the folks on both camps would time it and say, well, you gave them 18 seconds and you only gave us 14 seconds. We want you to, you know, retract that story.
You owe us 4 seconds, yeah.
So, I mean, that's how difficult it can be. You can't make everybody happy. You have to be happy within yourself as a journalist. And I always said, if I can go home at night and sleep well knowing I did a good job, that's I lived up to my ethics.
So let me ask the folks who have been most recently in commercial, and Adam is still there, about the subject of sweeps and franchises. I never liked it when I worked in commercial television news because I thought it sent the wrong signal to the viewer that the big stories happen 3 months out of the year. But I understand why, too, because sweeps, which is measuring ratings, only happen in essentially February, May, and November. July doesn't always view with the same kind of counting. But anyway, I understand sort of the pragmatics of that. And what I like now is I look at Adam's pieces. He has an Adam interview series, which is year long. I mean, you don't just time those for sweeps, which I'm really glad to see. But if you ever had a boss come to you and say, hey, we're going to do this franchise. When I say franchise, you know, Sinclair used to do a waste watch thing, like with you know, scary graphics and things like that, that I would push back on sometimes or say I'm not comfortable with the framing or this theme or whatever, and that led to some hard conversations. Has that happened to you? And in the context of ethics, how do you feel about sweeps, franchises, et cetera?
Well, I think sweeps done right can be an opportunity to get that time to complete a story because they will you several days to
right.
do it. So there have been several sweeps pieces. I did one on sex trafficking, and I was able to actually think about the piece, take my time interviewing the women. And I was more rewarded by that piece than almost any other day turn that I've ever done. So I think it can provide an opportunity. At the same time, there are pieces that are in our industry, sweepsy, which are basically built just to get viewership. And that's when your own standards come in and you can push back and you can say, you know what, I just don't feel comfortable doing that. I haven't had to do that, but I have seen it. So it is out there. And I think that the way we're measuring viewers will change sweeps over time. Right now, we're already in it. We're going to see cable companies give us numbers, satellite companies give us numbers, and that's going to be every single day. So we aren't going to have the book much anymore. So I'm going to be interested to see whether we even have those special months 5 years from now.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM. Thanks for listening all week, or if you're just tuning in for this podcast, thanks for listening to this too. You can catch us here every Friday afternoon for this review of the week. Until then, have a great weekend. I'm Megan Mack. Sending regards from Evan Dawson as well. We will talk to you Monday.